Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Bill Delaney. Robin Young is off today. It's Here and Now. A suicide car bomber struck today near the U.S. Marine camp on the outskirts of the Iraqi city of Fallujah. Two Marines were killed and six wounded. But the attack doesn't appear to have slowed the Marines' pullback from the city. An Iraqi force has begun moving into positions as part of a deal that's meant to restore calm to the city. Scott Peterson of the Christian Science Monitor is outside of Fallujah. Earlier, I asked him to describe how the pullout's going.
Basically, what we've seen are Marine positions, they're being pulled back is what's happening. They're not actually being pulled out. So what's happening is that the cordon is widening around Fallujah, and the reason for this, U.S. Commander's hearsay, is to give give some breathing space to the new Iraqi force, which is meant to be deployed in the coming days between 900 and 1,100 former Iraqi soldiers who are supposed to take the burden of security in Fallujah.
Who's leading the new Iraqi force?
This will be a former brigade commander in Saddam Hussein's army, and it's fairly controversial, the fact that such a person has been called in to run this force, although really what we're really seeing is a reversal of a policy that was decided upon almost a year ago to disband all of Iraq's military. This has been described in many quarters and by many analysts, Iraqi and Western alike, as being quite a mistake, because what it meant was we had nearly 450,000 or half a million people who all of a sudden were unemployed who had been members of Iraq's armed services.
At the same time, here's a man who was working in the apparatus, the military apparatus, of one of the most brutal dictators of the 20th century.
Well, that's correct, but U.S. Marine commanders here on the ground say that they recognize that not all members of Iraq's armed forces were black-hearted men. That's using their quotes. They're saying that in this case there may be good reason to hope that these people will be able to have some kind of influence. If, in fact, it works in Fallujah, then the same model may be applied to Najaf, where there also has been a serious insurgency, but of a different nature there with the Shia under Muqtada al-Sadr.
Scott, as a veteran correspondent, what do you make of this? Is this an admission of failure by the U.S. military, by the Marines, or is this, in fact, just very smart on their part?
I think in terms of the tactical decision made by U.S. Marines on the ground, it could prove to be very smart, because what it could prove ultimately is to save many Marine lives and probably many more Iraqi lives. But in terms of the broader strategy, it does indicate that the previous policy, which is of course made by politicians and not by soldiers, was not correct or was not right, and that there is some redeeming value in some elements of Iraq's former military under Saddam Hussein.
Scott, what's the expectation for this Iraqi force? We've heard about Iraqi police running, laying down their arms when shooting started in other places. There are still insurgents in Fallujah, and there's expectation in many quarters that they will continue to shoot at anyone who comes into that place and tries to announce themselves as in charge. What's the expectation for this force, this Fallujah Protective Army?
Well, ideally, I think the U.S. Marines are hoping, probably praying to a degree, that these people will be able to somehow convince the insurgents not to fight or actually stamp them out on their own. That is what they are hoping. That's a fairly tall order, because we really don't have any idea yet about how much influence they have over the insurgents. And one of the problems also that they will face, just as the Marines have faced, is the fact that the insurgents themselves are divided into three or four or five separate groupings. It appears that they have different motivations. They're fighting for different reasons. All of them, of course, with an anti-American stripe. So this, of course, complicates matters very, very much, and really, really makes commanders here recognize that they need a complex solution to deal with the complex problem.
Scott Peterson is correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor on the outskirts of Fallujah. Scott, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, now from Fallujah's present to lessons to be learned, perhaps, from its past. Sandra Mackey joins us from Atlanta. She's author of The Reckoning, Iraq, and the Legacy of Saddam Hussein. Welcome, Sandra.
nice to be with you.
Sandra, insurgents are still in Fallujah. U.S. troops are pulling back. That's not the outcome military planners would have wanted. Viewed historically, what most fundamentally do you think the Pentagon may have misread about Fallujah?
Well, I think the administration went into this whole war without any understanding of the internal dynamics of Iraq. The total concentration was on Saddam Hussein, and once Saddam Hussein was gone, that was the end of the problem. But there have always been two problems in Iraq. One was Saddam Hussein, and the other is Iraq itself. And in the last year, we have seen the tensions within the society, the Iraqis' great passion against foreign occupation, and we're really behind on the learning curve.
Sandra, Fallujah is a city of about 300,000 people. Who lives there? Who are the Fallujians?
Fallujah is a river industrial town. It is really a mix of people, but the major force there are the tribes. And the tribes have maintained their tribal way of governing themselves and their xenophobia about outsiders.
Tell us a bit about the history of these tribes when people from outside came into Iraq.
Well, the tribes really are a social necessity, or at least they were historically. And most of the time, there was never a government that could give protection to the inhabitants. So what you did was you had to provide your own protection, and therefore you did it through your family and your tribe. So what you have had in that region is people who are intensely independent. And they also did a pretty good job of holding off Saddam Hussein.
The British took over Iraq at the end of World War I. How did they fare dealing with the tribes of Fallujah?
Not well. By 1932, the British were ready to back off and turn it over to the Iraqis because they found that it was so difficult to try to keep control of these people. The British were doing somewhat what the United States would like to do right now, and that is to turn sovereignty over to the Iraqis and move into the background because the internal dynamics of Iraq are so complex and so volatile. It is just a very, very difficult country to rule.
And then there was a monarchy imposed by the British, created by the British from 1921 to 1958, and even an Iraqi monarchy had to kind of buy off these tribes, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the whole history of Iraq is this jockeying between all of these various groups. From 58 to 68, you had military governments. They actually largely didn't control Iraq through the military as much as they controlled it through the tribes. And then under Saddam, he really controlled Iraq only in the sense that he controlled the center of the country, and he controlled the rest of the country through his alliances with tribes.
How do you think this Fallujah Protective Army, which is being led by a former general of Saddam Hussein's army, will fare as it now becomes the main security force in Fallujah?
I think that's all going to depend on whether or not it's a patched-up group that the United States is trying to use to gain control of Fallujah. If it is actually the locals who have gotten themselves organized and have approached the Americans, and the Americans have said, let's go with this, I think that's good news.
Sandra Mackey joined us from Atlanta. She's author of The Reckoning, Iraq and the Legacy of Saddam Hussein. Sandra, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
The commander of the U.S. Military Detention Center in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, has been transferred to Iraq to supervise the treatment of detainees there. The transfer comes as military authorities investigate charges that Army reservists at the Abu Ghraib prison outside of Baghdad physically and sexually abused some of the detainees. Chilling photographs of the alleged abuse were shown on the CBS News magazine 60 Minutes 2 this week, including shots of prisoners with hoods on their heads, naked, forced to lie in a pile of bodies or to dance as American guards looked on, pointing and laughing. Military officials say six U.S. Army soldiers could be court-martialed. Joining us on the line is Gary Myers. He's a lawyer representing one of the soldiers, Army Reserve Staff Sergeant Ivan Chip Frederick. Welcome, Gary.
Thank you very much.
Gary, thanks for joining us. What does your client have to say about what happened?
Well, it's clear that he has some responsibility here. The question becomes whether or not it's criminal responsibility. Our position is, and one that I think is sustainable, is that he was immersed in a circumstance where there was very little training at the outset, virtually no guidance as to how he was to perform in this environment. Remember, he was a reservist. And then, of course, inducement to do the things that have been complained of by the military intelligence community.
Do you need training not to know to torture and humiliate people?
The word torture, I think, is a pejorative term that has no application to this case. These were techniques of humiliation, no question about that, that were meant to induce individuals to provide information to the United States. These men and women, the MPs, were told to soften up the prisoners by the intelligence community. The intelligence community was, in fact, in charge of the prison, which is utterly and totally inappropriate. Now, these MPs were sent into that environment. They had no idea what the rules were, but the circumstance existed before they came. It existed while they were there.
You say circumstances existed before they came, Gary. What do you mean?
I mean this idea of nudity and harassment of the detainees was not new. And I can tell you that these young people from Western Virginia certainly did not know that humiliation of Arabs was best done by way of nudity. This was a circumstance that was induced, and the idea that we have six rogue soldiers here simply is not supportable. Unlike these six very junior people, all of the senior people who have been relieved have simply received administrative admonitions, which we view as utterly and totally inappropriate.
Tell me about Army Reserve Staff Sergeant Chip Frederick. What does he do in civilian life?
Well, Chip is a 38-year-old individual from Western Virginia. He works in the penal system out there. He has prison experience in the civilian sector where rules are adhered to and where there is a standard rule of engagement as to how one handles prisoners. The environment in Iraq that he came into was much more laissez-faire, much more chaotic, and was done for the purpose of inducing the gathering of intelligence.
Gary Myers is the lawyer for Staff Sergeant Ivan Chip Frederick. The U.S. military in Iraq was unavailable for comment. Just ahead, the environmental cost of rapid growth in China. And later in the show, a Muslim watchdog group calls for a radio talk show host to be fired. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. Over the last two decades, China has shown spectacular economic growth. Private enterprises are flourishing, industry is thriving, and new construction seems to be springing up everywhere. But in the push to develop its economy, China has depleted and in some places ravaged its natural resources while pumping toxins into the air, water, and soil. Elizabeth Economy is author of a new book, The River Runs Black, The Environmental Challenge to China's Future. She's a senior fellow in Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. She joins us from New York, and welcome.
Thank you, Bill.
Elizabeth, thanks for joining us. I'd like to begin where you start your book, in eastern China and the Huai River, home to tens of thousands of small factories. Along parts of the river, you write, people have recorded higher than normal cancer rates and birth defects. Even though this is the river valley that's very much the breadbasket of China.
Well, the first major pollution accident in the Huai River was actually in 1994. And that spurred a major effort on the part of the government to clean up the river. Then again, in 1997, there was a second campaign that was designed to clean up the river. And in 2000, the Chinese government actually declared the campaign a success. Then again, in 2001, there was yet another major pollution disaster in which major fisheries were devastated, cropland was ruined by this polluted water. And you're absolutely right. The impact of this devastation was largely the result of all of these small-scale enterprises which basically have been free to simply dump their wastewater directly into the river without any treatment.
Now, the United States, 100 years ago or so, as it started to industrialize in an enormous way, was not worried about pollution and didn't start to think much about it, as far as I can tell, till not so long ago. Isn't this inevitable in a place like China that's exploding economically?
There's no doubt that any country that's been going through the kind of economic development that China has been experiencing is going to suffer some consequences in terms of environmental pollution and degradation. I think the problem that China confronts, however, is of a significantly different scale than anything that the United States encountered during its industrialization period. Roughly a quarter of China is now desert. And you have to remember that China is really only the same size as the United States. So just imagine the United States were already a quarter desert. You have 2,000 lakes and rivers in China simply drying up. And these are lakes and rivers that feed into the Yellow River, one of China's most important river systems.
Why are the rivers and lakes drying up?
Well, part of it is the fact that they're simply overutilized. And because of agricultural techniques, they don't have very good irrigation systems. They are pumping the water from underground water systems that are becoming dried up, which is why you have now the subsidence along the coastal areas where you hear that cities like Suzhou and Shanghai are actually sinking because they don't have the underground water systems that they used to have. As China's economy has grown, you have greater and greater demand. You have washing machines. You have people taking showers. Hours on a daily basis. All of these things are contributing.
Now, on the other hand, this month, April, Prime Minister Wen Jiabao of China suspended plans for a dam system on the New River, which flows along the border with Burma. Press reports seem to indicate that environmentalists in China were very surprised by this decision. In other words, they were surprised that he was being that progressive, right? What do you make of it?
Right. Well, I think Wen Jiabao represents a fundamentally new breed of Chinese leader. He is actually trained as a natural scientist and has served as sort of a supervisor of environmental policy for the past 8 years. So he has a technical knowledge of the environment that previous Chinese leaders have not possessed. I think the reason, too, that the Chinese non-governmental activists were so surprised is that they had really launched a campaign, and they'd launched campaigns before without this kind of high-level attention. And so the fact that Premier Wen Jiabao called a halt to the dam, at least for the time being, really was a first.
How indicative of a changing psychology in the leadership of China, if at all?
It is indicative of a changing psychology, but I think we have to wait to see what comes next. There are a whole raft of environmental challenges that China is currently confronting that need to be addressed. This is simply one sort of positive marker, but we need to see what Beijing is going to be able to do in terms of its skyrocketing rates of air pollution, of its water pollution, of its land degradation. Current indications are, for example, from last year to this year, there's been absolutely no improvement in the overall environmental statistics in China. This is despite a lot of speeches that have been made indicating, again, a new awareness of the environmental challenge. So I think we have to wait to see how implementation actually changes, where the rubber meets the road.
Elizabeth, I understand you just returned from an environmental conference in China. What did you hear there?
My sense is that the environmental activists are more enthusiastic and feeling more empowered than ever before. I think as they look across the countryside of China, they see that the environmental challenges are enormous, but I think that they feel the support of the Chinese people more than ever before, as well as support from China's environmental protection bureaucracy.
Is there a tipping point where it becomes so obvious to the leadership in China that environmental problems could hurt them economically that that's what really ignites more environmental consciousness in China?
I think that that tipping point has probably arrived.
Mm.
I think the statistics are out that China's environmental degradation and pollution now costs the Chinese economy the equivalent of 8 to 12% of the country's GDP annually. And I think the Chinese leadership is aware that, you know, as cities and towns are being forced to shut down their industries during the summer months because they don't have enough water, as crops are being ruined because of polluted water, I think they realize that they need to take action. I think the problem is going to be on the ground. And how is it that the central Beijing leadership persuades the local officials to start to take the kind of actions that are necessary to take?
Elizabeth Economy is with the Council on Foreign Relations, and she's author of the new book, The River Runs Black, The Environmental Challenge to China's Future. Elizabeth, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Next week on Here and Now, Israel's Likud party votes on Prime Minister Sharon's proposed plan to withdraw from the Gaza Strip and force settlements in the West Bank. And our jazz critic joins us with three new jazz CDs. That's next week. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. An American Muslim group is calling for a Boston radio talk show host, Jay Severin, to be fired because of remarks Severin made about Muslims.
Muslim fanatics are perfectly prepared and able to wage a 50-year, a 500-year, a 10,000-year war. And as part of that, what they've done is largely moved, a lot of them have moved into this country. Now, again, maybe I'm crazy here, but I think it pays to be a little suspicious. Knowing what we know about Islam, I don't see how we're not suspicious. And it pays to be very suspicious.
Well,
I believe that Muslims in this country are a fifth column.
Ibrahim Hooper is a spokesman for the Council on American-Islamic Relations, or CARE.
Muslims are tremendously upset and offended by these kinds of remarks. When we hear this day after day, and our children hear this too, and they're affected by it as well. We'd like to hear from the station management that they don't approve of these remarks and some action is going to be taken.
But Severin's radio station, WTKK, is standing by him. And Jay Severin himself declined to comment for this story. But here's Doug Bailey, spokesman for 96.9 WTKK Talk Radio.
We feel that Jay Severin has addressed this issue. He did express regret and apologize for any misunderstanding that has occurred as a result of his comments. His record is very clear on his feelings on these issues, and if anyone wanted to listen to those tapes, they would quickly realize that he is not a person who would say what he's been alleged to have said.
Joining us to discuss the controversy are Mark Jerkowitz, media critic for the Boston Globe. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
And Marvin Kalb of Harvard Shorenstein Center. Marvin, welcome.
Hi there.
Let's hear a part of the conversation that sparked all this. Jay Severin, in this conversation, has been talking to a caller about Muslims in America. Severin has suggested that many Muslims in America are more loyal to Islam than to the United States. The caller has suggested that we befriend Muslims. Severin asks the caller if he believes that we really should befriend Muslims.
I think
we should befriend them.
Well, I see Muslims in this country. They seem to like freedom.
Would you answer my question?
Yep.
Do you think we should befriend them?
I think we should. We should.
I'm going to try one more time.
Yes, I think,
the host
yes,
takes pains to phrase questions sometimes in a fashion such that the appropriate reply is a yes.
Yes,
or a no.
I think we should
this
befriend
is a three-strike state. You're
yes.
about to get your third strike.
Yes.
Do you believe we should befriend them?
Yes.
I've got good news for you. We have. Thanks for the call, and that's what I'm worried about. Jerry is calling from Saugus. Jerry, welcome. I think we should. I have an alternative viewpoint. It's slightly different than yours. You think we should befriend them? I think we should kill them. Jerry is calling from Saugus.
Marvin Kalb, your reaction.
Well, I think the comment that Jay Severin made just then is a rather stupid comment. If someone is known to be an enemy, if you're on a battlefield, even at the terrorist battlefield, yes, killing is required. But in this particular context, I don't think it's required. I think it's outrageous that he said it. Should never have come out of him at all.
Mark Jerkowitz, Severin says his listeners are loyal. They listen a lot, and so they know what he meant. From the many times he's been more specific, he says. Severin says he believes the terrorists killing us should be killed. Let me quote him quickly. If we were to make a tape of it, I could find maybe 1,000 recordings, Severin says, with my saying the following words. All Muslims are not terrorists. All Muslims are not our enemies. But so far, all the terrorists killing us are Muslims. Your thoughts, Mark Jerkowitz?
Well, you know, sometimes I think we actually sort of fall into a trap in terms of parsing all the words here. There have been a number of incidents in this city in the last year with talk radio, and when you go and look at the transcripts, I mean, you know, people don't say simple declarative sentences, I want to kill all Muslims or I want to do this. It's part of an ongoing conversation. But I think you can detect context here. I don't know enough about talk radio to know how many of Jay's listeners, what percentage of his listeners on any given day listen every day. I don't know how long they listen for. But it seems to me that someone tuning in at that point in that context could have thought of him as referring to Muslims in the United States of America. And it seems to me it's you know, the Globe did certainly correct the statement that we made, that was made about him saying, I want to kill all Muslims. Those words didn't come out of his mouth. But it seems like the context, and I agree with Marvin, is fairly clear here, and the statement is pretty outrageous. And I guess I would say if I were a talk show host, I'd want to make sure that everybody listening at any moment, at any time, knew exactly what I meant.
Right, Mark. There was a correction published in the Boston Globe. The paper had said in one report that Jay Severin said we should kill all Muslims. In fact, what Jay Severin said was, I have an alternative viewpoint. It's slightly different than yours, he says, referring to his caller. You think we should befriend them. I think we should kill them. Marvin Kalb, you know, I wonder if Jay Severin would ever say what he said, I think we should kill them, about Jews or blacks or Irish or Italians. Yet he feels he can say that about Muslims.
The fact is we are at war with a terrorist problem involving many Muslims, and there is an effort being made right now, I think, by intelligent people to try to reach out to Muslims, to try to understand what they're thinking, because they are on this planet and we have to live with them.
Mark Jerkowitz, any final thoughts on this?
Maybe the issue that the FCC needs to look at, and believe me, I'm a free speech advocate. What Jay said, you know, as I said, he's got a right to say it on the airwaves. But the real issue with In Talk Radio to me isn't indecency, but it's this kind of talk. As I said, there have been a number of cases in Boston this year. A man was fired at one radio station for roughly advocating sort of the destruction of the Palestinian people. Two talk hosts on a sports station who were suspended for making sort of equating a gorilla on the loose with some inner city students of color. A recent comment by someone on Jay's station that was racially insensitive. These issues keep cropping up over and over and over again. My opinion personally is that in the world of talk radio today, which used to be about political talk and has gotten increasingly more outrageous over time as it sort of pushes the envelope, many words have lost their meaning. You know, opponents use the term political correctness, but I think, you know, basic civility, acknowledging the rights of other groups, all this kind of stuff sort of goes by the boards these days when you've got those hot, angry microphones and angry callers and very few boundaries that are out there.
Marvin Kalb, you've been observing things for a long time. Is the level of discourse in this country sinking to a level that you haven't seen before? Now, that's not to say that Jay Severin isn't an extremely articulate voice on the radio, but the level of discourse.
I think I would agree with what Mark was saying a moment ago. I think that the level of discourse has dropped. I think that we are all in a competition to be mediocre, to be reaching towards some common center where people are assumed to be ignorant. I find this all very disturbing. We are now in a very dangerous world, and we have to find the intelligence and the way to deal with other people. We may not like them. They may not agree with us. We may not agree with them. But unless we wipe out other people, we've got to live with them. That's called coexistence. We managed to do it with the communists, and I think we ought to be able to do it with the Muslim world as well.
Marvin Kalb of Harvard Shorenstein Center joined us from Washington. Marvin, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
And Mark Jerkowitz is the media critic for the Boston Globe. Mark, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Here and Now. U.S. Undersecretary for Homeland Security Asa Hutchinson wraps up a week-long visit to Europe today, where he has been pressing European officials to adopt stricter security measures for air travelers coming to the United States. Undersecretary Hutchinson joins us now from Paris. Welcome, Undersecretary.
Good to be with you.
And thanks for joining us. Undersecretary, since 9/11, the United States has been demanding and imposing stricter security measures on flights from Europe to the United States. Flights have been canceled, as you know. Some in Europe have questioned the necessity for some of those cancellations. How concerned are Europeans about terrorism as compared to Americans?
Well, I think that there was some temptation to consider it just a U.S. problem. But obviously, after the attack in Madrid with the threats on the rail system in Europe, there's been an increasing awareness that this is clearly an international problem, that everyone shares the burden, and there's certainly been increased cooperation in recent months, and I think that will continue to build.
I know you went to Europe particularly concerned about a number of issues, but one issue, stolen passports. Tell us about how your concern about that was received.
Well, it was received well because there's a recognition that terrorists use stolen passports as a tool of the trade. We need to have a common data bank, if you will, where the international community will put information on stolen passports. It can be accessed so that whenever someone comes into a port of entry, that can be checked against that data bank of stolen passports. So we're developing that capability. I'm hopeful that that can work. We certainly need to have better information exchange on that.
What concrete progress did you make on that common data bank that you can tell us about?
Well, I think the progress was that there was an agreement to try to develop this. And so we're listening to each other's proposals, and I'm optimistic that we will be able to develop this capability in the coming months.
Often different standards between Europeans and Americans on a lot of things. One issue, passenger lists, sharing them. More concern apparently in Europe about privacy issues than perhaps in the United States. How did that go down?
We've made great progress there. We have to have information on passengers that we can protect and assure its privacy, but also use it to provide safety for the passengers' travel. And so we've reached an agreement with the European Commission. It was a close vote in the Parliament, but I expect that this information will be continue to be provided and will add a great safety measure for the traveling public.
How much more difficult now would it be for a Mohammed Atta or a Richard Reed to get on a plane in Europe and successfully enter the United States as compared to 2 years ago?
Substantially more difficult. Having said that, clearly when you live in a free society, there's always going to be concern about perfect security and where the next vulnerability is. But we are now using better information. We have better screening capabilities. We also have better inspection at our ports of entry. It would be much more difficult with those layers of security. And, of course, I would have the hope, as we have in some instances in the past, that we could prevent a terrorist from coming in or accomplishing their goal.
U.S. Undersecretary for Homeland Security Asa Hutchinson joined us from Paris. Undersecretary, thank you so much.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts. Our interview with European Union Commissioner Margot Wallström over differences between the Union and the Bush administration over environmental issues brought this letter from Dave Lilly of Plainfield, New Hampshire. I will never understand why so many of you in Boston continue to slam Bush for refusing to sign treaties designed to reduce greenhouse gases. Then every single weekend, about a half million of you jump in your SUVs and drive to Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine. At times, our roads up here look like we have been totally overrun by people from Massachusetts, New York, and Connecticut. I swear, there has to be more suburbans in Boston than in all of Texas and Wyoming combined. Well, Joseph Gallucci of Phoenix, Arizona, had this bone to pick with an interview we did on a Jordanian television documentary which aired confessions of accused terrorists. He writes, "I listened with much dismay when Robin asked if the accused terrorist showed remorse or apologized. I wonder what answer she expected. Is this the sort of question she wants to ask all terrorists or terrorist members? Does she want to pose the same question someday to Osama bin Laden?" During our segment on same-sex marriages, which will be permissible following a ruling by the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, we called same-sex marriage gay marriage, which provoked a call on our listener line from Reverend Edward Franks, a Massachusetts resident.
Two persons of the opposite sex can get married regardless of their sexual orientation. Nobody asked them. From the May 17th, two persons of the same sex will be able to get married regardless of their sexual orientation. And although the vast majority, I presume, will be gay or lesbian persons, it is conceivable that two straight people, two straight men, two straight women, two bisexual men, two bisexual women, you name it, will be able to get married. It's same-sex marriage. The SJC did not rule on sexual orientation, it ruled on the permissibility of two persons of the same sex to get married.
A recent segment on whether the media did not pay enough attention to terrorist issues prior to 9/11 brought this response from Clarence Ellis of Charlotte, North Carolina. "Your discussion lacked sincerity. The major media conflict that suppressed attention to American security revolves around the need for media outlets to make money versus their social, political, and cultural duty to provide important public information. As witnessed by the spread of the print and live tabloid news business, the American marketplace supports popular junk news over serious public education." And finally, avid comic book fan Andrew Hinterman of Cambridge, Massachusetts, enjoyed a review we did of Kill Bill Volume 2, but he had this quibble. "I was curious as to why you referred to it as Quentin Tarantino's comic book movie. As far as I know, this film isn't based on a published comic book." Later in the review, it was pointed out that the violence in Kill Bill Volume 1 was cartoonish, which it was, but I hope that this isn't why you called it a comic book movie. There's a big difference between cartoons, comic strips, and comic books.
I am Superman, and I know what's happening. I am Superman.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and the town where you live. Actor Robert De Niro is probably best known for certain genres, mob movies, cop films, crime dramas. But he's no stranger to comic roles, like in Meet the Parents. And he's even done horror films, playing the monster in Kenneth Branagh's 1994 adaptation of Frankenstein. Well, now De Niro tries his hand at science fiction with a supernatural twist in Godsend. Here De Niro plays Dr. Richard Wells, a brilliant doctor and researcher. When the son of a former student is killed in a freak accident, the infertility specialist offers the grieving couple a chance to start over by resurrecting the dead child in a super-secret experiment.
My clinic has perfected a procedure by which a single cell could be used to create a genetically identical fetus. A fetus which could be carried to term and, in effect, be reborn.
Do you mean cloned?
Yes.
To find out how well De Niro fares in a sci-fi thriller and whether Godsend will live up to its title for filmgoers this weekend, we're joined by Here and Now's film reviewer, Eric Schaefer. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Bill.
Eric, the contemporary level of this movie is that it involves stem cells. But this is part of a long tradition, or and even a growing tradition of movies that are about the possibility of somebody being reborn.
Right. We've got a number of movies fairly recently, like AI, which dealt with creating a robotic child. You had a number of clone films, actually, back in the 1970s, kind of grungy B-movies. But, you know, cloning was a hot issue back then as well. And then, of course, this also ties in with that whole genre of sort of devil child movies, whether we're talking about The Omen or The Others or The Shining or, of course, The Exorcist. So we're treading some pretty familiar ground in this movie.
But it's fun ground a lot of the time.
A lot of the time it is. But this movie starts out with a pretty unpleasant premise. We have this couple, Paul and Jesse Duncan, who have this very nice, stable life in the city. And that's all blown apart one day after the 8th birthday of their child, Adam. He is killed in a traffic accident. And so this figure from the wife, Jesse's past, comes onto the scene. Richard Wells, played by Robert De Niro, he's a genius, a scientist, a doctor, and he offers them this chance to clone their son. And so they agree to pick up stakes, to leave the city, to move to a very secluded small town in rural Vermont, where they conduct this experiment, and it all goes well. At least up to the clone's 8th birthday, and then things begin to go wrong.
Adam's changing. He's getting worse. Sometimes it's like there's two of them. He's destructive. He's trying to harm himself. The other kid's screw scared of him, Richard. There's something you're not telling us.
And, of course, we've got the perfect setting for this. You've got, you know, this beautifully appointed old Victorian house, which has a kind of creepy edge. You've got the nasty old tool shed out in the woods. You've got Dr. Wells' very clean, high-tech, creepy fertility lab.
And not only that, there's something particularly creepy about an evil child.
Oh, there always is. And this kid, Cameron Bright, who plays Adam, is creepy. It's not like he's a good actor, but there's something sort of blank in this sort of little pie-faced kid that is sort of unsettling.
That's the worst, when the evil children are sort of blank.
Yeah, but unfortunately this whole movie is kind of a blank too, because we're dealing with a script that is fairly predictable. Poor Greg Kinnear and Rebecca Romijn Stamos, who play the parents, just don't have a whole lot to do. I mean, you know, look distraught one minute, then happy the next, then suspicious the moment after that.
Interested as we are in how they fare, what about De Niro?
Poor Bobby De Niro. I mean, he just really seems to be phoning it in. This is a real empty performance from him. He appears to be just going through the motions. Even as the movie progresses and he gets the chance to become increasingly sinister, there's just not a lot going on there.
Premier actor of his generation. You remember so many films, Taxi Driver, Raging Bull. Is he still a great actor?
De Niro, I think, still has the capacity to be a great actor.
He must.
But, you know, I think one of the issues is he's probably a workaholic. He is somebody who needs to be practicing his craft constantly. You just look at the number of movies that he's in this year or that are coming out later in the year. It's incredible. So I think the guy just, you know, is not terribly selective about the roles he's taking.
Eric Schaefer reviews films for Here and Now. Eric, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Bill.
Now is a production of WVUR Boston. Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, Emiko Tamagawa, Jordana Gustafson, Ann Stevenson, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Thomas Terry. Our web producer is Zach Christo. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Bill Delaney. Get into your radio and join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.